Hello and welcome back to the Wheelbarrow Full of Dicks Internet Radio Program. I am Mike, joined by Napier Drunk. Travis, are you still there?
Travis is still here.
Travis is here, and we are joined by Connor Rickman and Whit Hertford of Wildlife. Hey.
How's it going?
How's it going, guys?
Good, good, good.
Did you see this potato salad guy?
On Kickstarter, yeah. I saw something about it. What is it?
Doesn't it just irritate you? I mean, the guys asked for $10 to make some potato salad. And what was it up to, Travis? We just looked at it little while ago.
He is now at $37,000 with 25 days to go.
That's a lot of potato salad.
I mean, like, here you guys are. You're trying to make something legitimate. You're trying to make, like, a movie, tell a story. And this guy just wants to make some potato salad.
Yeah, you're putting salt in the wound, man.
I could have made him some potato salad. I would have gone to his house.
You know, here's the thing. Not to, like, alienate anybody, so I'll be incredibly generic and overgeneralize. We're not the smartest species. You know what I mean?
I will alienate and overgeneralize. I will say that the guy who started that Kickstarter is a genius, and everybody who donated $37,000 to his Kickstarter should be ashamed of themselves.
But that's the thing. That's why we have real, not to be like get all philosophical, right? But that's why we have reality TV. That's why we've got kind of a sloppy like Cineplex slate of movies. Is that, like, people actually think it's kind of funny to screw it all up.
Well, and that was a question that I was going to ask you, is that, you know, we're so far away, Hollywood is so far away from the golden age embrace of, like, the Miramax, Kevin Smith era of, like, big, big, low-budget releases, that how is it even possible to put these smaller stories in front of people? I mean, is that essentially why you've kind of branched out and decided to write your own material and then obviously turned to Kickstarter to try to fund that, since I would imagine independent financing is a lot harder to come by than it used to be?
Yeah, I mean, Kickstarter is one way to do it, but I mean, even if the whole project goes tits up, we're still going to make it somehow. You know, we'll sell some plasma or something, you know, we will find a way. And, you know, and it's like, you know, we can maybe ask a couple of rich people for money. Right now we're asking a bunch of poor people for money.
Make some damn potato salad.
Yeah. Clearly I'm in the wrong business. I should have gotten my PhD in potato salad. And,
you know, the thing is like, as jaded as I am, as much of like a curmudgeon I am at times, I actually do really firmly and maybe to a default am hopeful that the rest of the planet is populated with people that have the same kind of hearts and brains that I have, more or less, probably more brains than I have, but that they want stories that resonate and, you know, stay with you, that they actually make an impact, the movies of our childhood and movies that actually made us like movies. I still think those can be made. I just think that we have to be a little louder, we have to be a little angrier, and we have to actually just not really, in the words of Network, you know, not take it sitting down.
Well, there's been plenty of people, I think, who found their niche in creating smaller movies. I think, like, the Duplass brothers, you know, are ones that come to mind right off the bat. And all they do is make, you know, really small movies. I mean, hour and 20 minutes of two characters kind of just traveling around bullshitting, you know, but the stories are generally endearing, and those are the kind of movies, like me being a movie lover, that those are the ones that stick with me for a couple of days, rather than, as much as I really do like going to the Cineplex and grabbing a pair of 3D glasses and watching, you know, the fifth incarnation of Spider-Man in 10 years, I enjoy that as an experience, but not so much as, you know, a story that I'm actually going to get something from.
And I think it's cyclical. I think the worst thing is to kind of be a defeatist and to say, like, oh, all hope is gone, it's a lost cause, we're never going to get it back. I think it really goes in waves. And, you know, if you look at historically, there was a time when, you know, the people of of the Scorseses and Coppolas and Spielberg and Lucas, they were making movies that were new and challenging, that were a lot more about, at least early Spielberg, were a lot more about characters and story, and that was a little bit foreign to audiences. And then again, you mentioned Kevin Smith, and you mentioned, you know, that era. It came back. And I think the exciting news is that I think guys like us, hopefully, are going to be jumping into the lineup and catching the new wave.
Well, and I think you're right, too, because I think that, you know, that there is a batch of filmmakers right now, too, and they're getting major press now. I mean, obviously, J.J. Abrams is a huge force, but you can see, you know, Spielberg-esque qualities to everything he does. Where it's, you know, you feel like Super 8, you know, it felt like a homage to E.T. You have guys like Rian Johnson who you know, did Looper, which felt like it was a genre piece, but
right.
It was a good story, you know. So you have these filmmakers that are starting to get, you know, out there a little bit more because they're being offered things like Star Wars and Star Trek, but they're people who actually have a story in mind, and I think that's ushering in opportunities, you know, for guys like you who want to tell that story, you know, that emotional tale, to actually be able to succeed.
I think what has happened in the past has been, it used to be your access to the infrastructure that sort of was the filter for making films. And recently, in the last 10 years, with the big film, you know, film and video technology boom, kind of everyone can be a filmmaker just by having an iPhone. And it's such a, you know, it's freeing, it's great, you know, it gives everybody an opportunity. But what it does is it passes the responsibility of filtering what content you want to see and what content you will digest and take into your own life and what will have an effect on you. It passes that responsibility onto the viewer. And that's not something that viewers have ever really been used to. We kind of had these established systems in place to say, like, okay, if a studio is releasing it, it must be good. And now, so many small independent studios, essentially, are releasing so much content that it's fallen on the viewer to determine what they consider to be viewable. And it's a responsibility that is so new, I think it's going to take a little while for people to get used to. But I think it's an exciting future because it puts the power in the hands of the viewer, which, you know, call me a socialist if you want, but I think it's a pretty great thing.
Yeah, no, and I think, I mean, you look at, there's probably one thing right now that is firing on all cylinders, that's generally accepted, that is the voice of the people, that is accurate, and that actually does speak up for films that matter. And that's a thing like Rotten Tomatoes. You know, everyone cites that and sources that because it's pretty foolproof. And I think that's because people's voices are heard and they get to judge it and gauge their own opinions up against everybody else's.
Well,
so do you think that's a good... Go ahead, Mike.
To bring it back to the movie that you guys are actually making sort of broadly, the thing that jumped out at me when I watched the video is you don't really give anything away actually what the movie is about. It's very it's vague, and I assume you did that on purpose, and I like that just because I'm tired of seeing the whole movie in the movie trailer. Like, Napier, you remember that movie with the Rachel McAdams that she got Harrison Ford to be the TV anchor? No, you don't remember that.
Oh yeah,
yes, yes.
I remember.
The Good Morning America.
The whole movie was in the trailer.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I mean, first of all, I don't know why I ended up going and seeing that movie. But
why did you watch that movie?
I did. I saw it. It was awful. But the whole movie was in the trailer. They summed it up in 2 minutes. And when I watched this the video that you posted, I mean, I got a vibe as to, you know, kind of the tone, but I didn't actually get any of the info. I mean, it seemed kind of like it might be like a Hatfields versus McCoys type thing. I don't really know exactly what it was, though.
Good, and that's the point, because then I think not only is interest peaked, then people come back for more, and we'll parse out a little bit more update by update on purpose. But I also am with you 100%. I don't really want people, even in a crowdfunding, you know, campaign, to have a full grasp of the movie. I think that that's where, you know, Zach Braff, Veronica Mars, there's a whole slew of reasons why that isn't a fantastic thing. But one of those reasons is because they really were desperate and they really threw it all out there, and they seemed like they were kind of begging with no real like material to beg with. And that movie's already gotten slammed. The Braff one's already gotten slammed. It's got terrible reviews. It's going to, again, sour people on Kickstarter. And for guys like Connor and myself and Ryan, our director, it's like, well, look, we only have story to come at you with this. I mean, yeah, we have Heater, and we have a couple people that make you go, oh, okay, they're not completely random. But, you know, John is not in a place where he is going to be any sort of like fluff in this performance, where he's going to, I mean, I'm probably one of three guys in the world that can say, John, if you make a corny joke right now, I'm going to punch you in the ball.
Well, and that was another question I had, is this doesn't seem like a comedy.
It's not a comedy at all.
You kind of come from like a comedic background, and John Heder, of course, was Napoleon Dynamite. I mean, if you came to me and said, hey, I'm going to make a gritty, drama, and I'm going to cast Napoleon Dynamite as a sheriff, I have questions about that. That's
And then also add Lauren Lapkus as his wife.
his Mormon wife. I mean, we do things in this movie that are just enough that it's going to make people teeter on their uncomfortability, but we're not doing anything to alienate or have an agenda, or I don't have any big soapbox I'm standing on. I just wanted to be genuine about the people here, the people that I know live in Utah, in that middle section of the demographic that's never ever cinematically been aptly portrayed. And I feel like it's a pretty specific and cool corner of the world, just like, or the country, just like Fargo took Minnesota Nice, and nobody really knew that as a specific thing until that film. And there was a lot of, that's my favorite movie, is Fargo, and so there was a lot of that and the writing of Sam Shepard that influenced Wildlife 20 years ago when I started writing notes on this. I come from a comedic background. John comes from where he comes from. But that's what's exciting to me, is that nothing is ever worthwhile unless you continually invent and create and surprise people. And thank heaven for John Heder that he's actually willing to completely face plant in a good way this time. He's done face planting with Rob Schneider, thank heaven. but he's ready to do it in a way he's never done it before. I mean, are we allowed to swear on this thing?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, yep.
Okay, so the script has the word fuck on it every two pages because there are meth dealers, there are metalheads in this movie. They don't talk nice. And John Heder is a pretty straight-laced dude in his real life, but he knows a good script when he reads it because he gets a lot of bad ones. And he read it and he said, I'm not offended, I'm ready to go. This is the left turn I need to take. And I said, good, because I wrote this for you. And if you had said no, I would have been pissed off.
You wrote it with him in mind?
Yeah, I was living in John's house from September, July to October of last year. I was in his guest house as like the weird uncle in the back.
And I think that... I know that it's interesting to look at a film like this and think, okay, Lauren Lapkus is a funny person, John Heder's a funny person, how can they pull off a serious movie like this? But that was exactly what everybody was saying when Tarantino put Travolta in a movie where he wasn't disco dancing.
Well, and Robin Williams too, I guess.
Yeah, exactly.
When he was the creepy photo guy.
I think actors are at their best when they're being stretched beyond what they are comfortable with and what their audiences are comfortable with. It challenges both the performer and the actor, or performer and the audience.
It's the old Bill Murray equation, and it works, but it doesn't work with everybody. I studied at the Upright Citizens Brigade in Los Angeles for about 5-7 years, and I did okay, but I clearly didn't like break through the comedy walls because I'm a I'm a freaky looking guy. I come from the Steve Buscemi, Paul Giamatti school of jacked up faces. And so what I spent most of my time at UCB doing was watching from afar the people that I felt like Lauren, like Matt Jones, who's on Breaking Bad and who did our debut movie, feature length, Dreamworld. And he is not Badger the Stoner from Breaking Bad in that. He's not a complete burnout. He's a multifaceted character. He plays my character's high school bully, and they finally get to confront one another 15 years later. And it's a moment that really happened in my real life when I was at 24 Hour Fitness, and my real high school bully had me in a headlock as adult men, and I thought my life was going to end, and he actually just wanted to chum out, and it was a really like heartwarming, touching moment. And so I presented that to Matt Jones, and you know, it's there's certain kinds of comedic actors that, because they never get this type of material, when somebody takes a flyer on them and endows them with supreme confidence, they thrive. And it's a very exciting moment, and it's what I continually try to do.
Well, going back to the pitch video itself, I know that Mike actually had texted me the link to it and said, you know, these would be, you know, some interesting guys to talk to. And I actually watched it during work, you know, because I had wanted to brush up on and see what you guys were doing. And I mean, what is it, about a 6-minute pitch video? The video itself, although you don't really talk about what the movie is outside of, like, the environment and how it's almost, you know, it's the wrong side of the tracks kind of a thing, the pitch video itself, to me, felt like a short film. It felt like a narrative. So when I was done with it, I got a sense of, although maybe not the story, about the tone you were going for. And I to be completely honest, as soon as that song kicks in at the end when the pitch video was over, I truthfully got goosebumps when it was done.
That's our good friend Joshua James.
Yeah, Josh is from the land, and he is the love child of Bon Iver and Bob Dylan. He's the real deal. I have no idea why he's not gigantically famous outside of the fact that he chooses not to be. He's turned down huge record contracts to be able to independently put out his music and kind of live on his farm here in rural Utah and be kind of a real man of the soil here, very much salt of the earth. And when you talk to him, he's a unique guy that's not faking it at all, but he feels sort of old world frontier. And he's going to kill in this movie. I mean, he's pulling a Tom Waits in that he's never acted a day before in his life. And I'm handing him over, frankly, my favorite role in the script. The one I'm playing is not even my favorite role. His is. And that just shows you either, A, I'm insane, or B, I like to do things that usually pan out. And I like jumping off the high dive. I like skydiving from a great height and doing something with a huge potential to fail. I like doing that. And his music is a huge character of this movie. The way that video looks is all accredited to the guy sitting next to me, Connor Rickman. And the cool thing about Sneak Attack and what we try to do to not over, you know, glorify ourselves, but is that it's individuals, including and specifically Ryan Darst, the director, and my partner, the Wayne to my Garth. He's a visionary that wears cargo shorts. He doesn't have an air about him, but he's a guy that definitely needs to be seen and heard. And I've lived probably 7 of my 9 cat lives in only 35 years. And so I have a lot of stuff I want to say cinematically. So we're going to do this, and we're going to do it the way we want to do it, with zero compromises. And that's how we took a movie like Dreamworld that was made on blood, sweat, tears, insanity, and only $7,000. And we got it to Amazon and iTunes. And that's gigantic for a little movie like that that didn't get to any first-tier festival. So we have success doing it. We needed better pieces, and I needed to write this script, which required me moving up to this place and disassociating myself from an LA zip code, and I'll tell you what, it was the greatest idea I've ever had.
So with a movie like this, you know, you said you'd started writing it a long time ago. Did you start with the location? Did you start with Utah and say, I want to set a movie here? Or did the story just lend itself to be told there? I know you said that, you know, it's about a group of people, you know, or a sect of people that live in that place. But I mean, was there a story in mind, or did you just look at the place and say, I need to put something here?
Well, 20 years ago when I was in college, not 2015, I'm dating myself, but I read Lie of the Mind, True West, and Fool for Love, all Sam Shepard plays. And they really spoke to me how he was the voice of this Western sort of fictitious place, the desert, the mountains. And he's just always been very inspirational to me. And when I saw Fargo, I thought, well, that seems like that's kind of in the same boat. You know, they're both taking a subsect and showing all the colors and not really making any sort of judgments to be like, these guys are dorks or dimwits and these are the ones you should root for, that everybody kind of gets a fair shake. And so between that, between some stuff that happened in my real life a year ago where I got a really close front row seat to, not to be a complete downer, but abuse and mental illness, and just getting really shocked to what close relationships, how they can unravel, how they can get really scary. And so I guess the thing that was the cincher was that I went, well, the light moments in Wildlife, which were still, you know, scraps, they were sort of, I write in scenelets and then I try to kind of string them together. At least that's how I did this one. And I thought, you know, you take the Oh You Betchas and the Heck Do You Mean from Fargo and you substitute that with the gosh darn gall fetch of Utah County, and that seemed like a pretty easy you know, switch up. And sure. So that kind of happened, and it started to write itself as soon as I moved here. I had what I now was a really, really terrible, rough first third of the screenplay. But then when I got my feet actually in the dirt here, it went really, really fast. And it's interesting, when we walked down to Springville, when I was kind of looking at the places there and being in that actual town, there were people coming out wondering what this guy was doing in his Scion, just cruising their train tracks. And I told them, I said, it's hopefully for a movie about Springville and all the sides of the tracks, good, bad, light, and dark. And they were thrilled. And I got goosebumps. I thought, this is a cultural thing that could happen here, where not only does Springville get to get a little bit of the spotlight, but Utah County, small town America. And I think that sometimes is done in a very homogenized way as far as Hollywood standards. And people don't really reach in and pull out the guts, because Hollywood doesn't need to do that. They need to do what is the bare minimum to make their big dollars. And usually that doesn't require laying it all out on the altar. But like I said, I've done a lot of stuff in my life already, and I don't have a desire to be famous, but I have a desire to tell stories. And so that's why I think this comes from a different point of view.
Well, I'm really excited to see what the story is too, because just if the same guy is shooting the movie that shot the pitch video, I mean, just from a stylistic point of view, it looks like it's going to be really something to take in.
The guy who's shooting the actual film is about 10 times better than I am, so you're going to see just about the best looking version of Utah you've ever seen in a movie.
But the cool thing, though, is, like, you know, Connor is kind of producer boy here, and he's the brains behind the operation, but he does have an eyeball, and he does know he's acted a little bit too. Ryan has acted a little bit too. I've directed a little bit too. So it's a real you know, collaborative effort. And I've made efforts to meticulously cast people that want to be part of basically a theater repertory on film. And that's what we try to do each time out.
And that's kind of more along the lines of the all hands on deck, you know, everybody pitching in with every bit of the movie to make the best thing that possibly can be, rather than you have your job, I have my job, and, you know, we walk away at the end.
Totally. I mean, when we are talking to people that could potentially land us larger sums of money, I think about things that I've been accustomed to from when I was a whippersnapper, things like trailers and stuff like that. I'm actually grossed out by that. I don't want trailers, and I don't want people to check in and check out in between scenes. I want this to be like a play, and I want everybody to be all in all the time. And when we've done that, when we did that with Dreamworld, when we did that with a heist, sort of a, if Wes Anderson had directed the Bourne movies, we did a thing called The Capricorn with John and I. We're the head of this kind of DIY heist team that Kyle Mooney from SNL, he was a part of that film, and we tried to make it a web series, but again, nobody really takes risks on things that are good right now, so we kind of got shelved. But we have put that into play where everybody is there, and the luxuries, it's not like we're trying to make anybody feel punished, but the luxuries and the perks are at a bare minimum so that everybody is dialed in at all times. And it's great. I mean, again, I bring up Wes Anderson. That guy puts people in tents and in the same hotel. And these are people that are doing giant, giant movies, but they love going to film camp. And they love being part of that environment where people are eating meals together and they're not cloistering themselves in a corner.
And they love to be symmetrical, right in the middle of the frame at all times.
Exactly.
Well, that's the thing. It's got to be fairly boring to just be the actor guy that shows up to set, and you say your three lines, you walk away, and then they don't call you back, or maybe they call you back a little bit too early.
Yeah, you know, when I did, and I had a fun time on this show, but I mean, I'll out them because it's the complete opposite. I did the first season of Glee, and I did the third episode when nobody knew that it was going to be gigantic, and the kids were still pretty normal human beings at that point. I got there, and I had a huge monologue to deliver, and I was pretty nervous, and I didn't even get a rehearsal. It was basically like, here's your mark. You better nail it, and it better be the funniest damn thing we've ever seen. If not on take one, then definitely by take two, or you may not be in this episode. And that amount of pressure and stress is not for everybody, and really, really doesn't lend itself to quality with any sort of longevity. I think that that's very short-lived, and it's very canned, and it's hurtful to the art form. The art form needs to be breathed. It needs to have energy and life. And, you know, we're still on Kickstarter, but the girl that plays my love interest in this film, we've already spent a lot of time in the mountains, improvising as characters, asking.
Is that code?
No. We don't Blue Valentine it. We get close. Mary Kate and I during Dreamworld, we really did spend a lot of time together, and I really kind of saw Mary Kate as a lovely human being, and we had a bit of a crushy crush going on during that filming, and so you watch that movie and you're kind of watching a pseudo documentary, and you know, it's not ideal for the personal life, so you need to be able to turn it off and on, especially if you have a significant other, but I think you got to at least push yourself and do the things that are scary. If you do anything that's safe in this art form, I think that you're really looking to be disappointed.
Well, thank you guys for doing this. I set up a website just to make it easier for people to find. It's just tinyurl.com/WFODwild. So if you do want to check out the Kickstarter, just go there, or just Google it, I guess. But yeah.
And the Kickstarter runs through July 25th.
Correct. 25th. Yeah. Thanks, guys, for doing that. That's really nice of you.
No problem. And
absolutely. Hey, give me one quick second. I would feel bad if I didn't bring this up, Whit. I brought
up. Oh no!
No,
is this the Nightmare on Elm Street 5 question?
It's come up on the show a couple of times in the last couple of weeks that I'm going to see Robert Englund in full Freddy garb in Chicago.
Wow.
August 8th. He's doing like a one night thing, and I think the guy Robert Kurtzman, I believe, is applying the makeup for it. And he, I think, was the makeup artist on Nightmare on Elm Street 5, the Dream Child. And you were the titular Dream Child in that motion picture.
I've never had the word titular paired with me, ever.
I want to tell you that as a 9-year-old, and I shouldn't have been in the theater probably, but when you first came on screen, I was very jealous, and I was like, who is this kid who's only a couple of years older than me who gets to be Freddy Krueger's kid in this movie? You know, it was...
Well, look, buddy, how often did you get beat up in school?
Quite a bit.
Okay, then we did have very similar lives. I was going to say that's the trade-off. You know, my friends went to soccer practice.
Well, I was going to say that was a prerequisite.
Right, exactly. Yeah, I mean, I'm sorry I made you jealous. I'm a pretty...
No, that's all right. Well, you have a long list of credits, and I guess really what the question was is, you know, as many different projects as you've been associated with, is like, what is it like to be associated with, even in a small part, of a genre franchise? I mean, I know Jurassic Park and those kind of things. I mean, is it something that is endearing? I mean, do you embrace that, or is it just kind of like, that was a job I had when I was, you know, way back in the day?
Well, I think I'd be an asshole if I wasn't grateful, right? So
sure.
I definitely see it from the fan point of view. I definitely realize that it could have been the Ernest movies instead. And,
oh, that would have been awesome.
But at least, you know, it was fucking Jurassic Park and a part of the Nightmare legacy. And I'm honored by that. I hope that that's not when I peaked. That's the only thing I hope to hell that that's not what's on my tombstone. But yeah, I'd be remiss to not be 100% grateful and all those things, even the corny 90s sitcoms I learned stuff from, and I've taken it with me. Robert Englund, you know, I'm only a year older than you, FYI. I was only 10 when I did that.
Okay.
And when I did it at a time when my dad had just passed away in a really horrific, sudden manner 6 months before we started shooting. And credit to my mom, she didn't, you know, let us sit around and mope. She said, let's keep ourselves active and busy, and let's keep making life choices. And so I did that movie very, very intrigued and not scared, intrigued by the makeup. And, you know, they had like 3 airplane hangars worth of sets. It was gigantic. And I was really thrilled with working on that movie. And Robert was a good man, and really took me under his wing. And Steve Hopkins was one of the most amazing directors I've ever worked with. He, you know, bought me a skateboard on my last day, and that to a 10-year-old kid is gold. So, yeah, man, I know that I'll probably, until I'm dead, have those credits associated to my name, but that's okay, because it's all part of the experience and the tapestry. I just hope that I get to do some stuff that I think is a little closer to me rather than being a hired hand.
Well, I think judging by this project, I don't think you have any, there's really no chance of you ever being, you know, labeled that kid that did that movie. So I don't think you have to worry about that.
Well, thanks. My neck beard and my B cup man boobs are not childlike anymore.
Cool. Well, thanks again, guys. And yeah, tinyurl.com/WFODwild.
Thanks, guys. We really appreciate it.
Take it easy.
Thank you, guys.
See you later.